right, well, first, thank you very much, Greg, for the opportunity to give this talk. When he first asked me if I would do this, I thought, sure, you know, my research is kind of Blackboard friendly. I'd be happy to go up and talk about it for an hour. So I accepted without reservation. But then a couple days later, he proceeded to ask if I would give a research talk, you know, on Friday. And so I thought, well, sure, but then, you know, then I realized that I wasn't sure what I was supposed to talk about today. All right, so today will be rather, obviously related to my research interests, but not hopefully too focused on it. And I guess what I'd really like to do is act as kind of a facilitator or moderator in a discussion of some of the major transitions in evolution. And part of the reason that I wanted to have this be more discussion-oriented is because I knew that with this crowd, I would not be able to have it be anything but that, so I figured it'd be better just to start with that as the goal. So in particular, I guess around the major transitions, I want to try to think about what some of these transitions might have in common. In particular, well, just so I have some sense of the audience, can I have, maybe you could raise your hand if you do not study living systems of some sort for research? All right, wow. Okay, or maybe I should have asked it the other way around. How many of us actually do study living something? All right, so it's maybe even a minority or the living something. Okay, that is that's perfect.
You speak to the majority.
Yes, well, or at least a sizable minority. All right, so it's perfect. But I will work very hard to try and avoid any jargon associated with biology. You know, I am of course a physicist by training, and I only took the one required undergraduate class at MIT when I was an undergraduate in biology. So that's all the biology that I really know, and I've been trying to pick it up ever since then. So I will try to avoid jargon, but please, if I or someone else starts going off on a tangent using a lot of words, vocabulary that you don't know, then please just we can have a code word of some sort, and we can try to explain things as we go. Okay, major transitions in evolution. If I were a little bit taller, I would be able to use the full dynamic range of this blackboard, but unfortunately not. The reason that I'm here is associated with the workshop that's cooperation and the evolution of multicellularity, right? So it's very clear in that case that if you have individual cells and they're going to somehow tie their fates together, and that's some sort of cooperative behavior. But what I want to do is over the next hour talk about the major milestones in the course of the evolution of life, and how in many, many cases, what ties them together is there's a sense that there is a combination of replicators at one scale that are cooperating and forming structure and organization at a higher scale. Okay. So it may be that the combination of cooperation and multicellularity is not is not particular to that transition in evolution, but is really, I think, a rather ubiquitous feature of some of the major events in the history of life over the last 4 billion years. All right, and in particular, maybe what we will do is, in order to start the discussion nature, I'll maybe have some suggestions from the audience on what their favorite major transitions in evolution are. And I'll just mention that you can argue, of course, about which are the major transitions. My thoughts on this, of course, have been heavily influenced by some of the work of John Maynard Smith. Talked about this, but also, if any of you are looking for a good evolution textbook, I recently came across this book called Creatively Evolution by Bergstrom and Dugatkin, and that I've really quite been enjoying. So if any of you are looking for a good evolution textbook, I will recommend that one. All right, so somewhere in here, we will certainly mention multicellularity, and I'll go ahead and put it. Put it over here. to indicate that it's somewhere in the middle of the list of major transitions we'll be talking about. All right, maybe favorite transitions. Does anybody have one that that's especially dear to their hearts?
Incorporation of mitochondria.
All right, mitochondria. All right, so, you know, well, let's see. And do you, should we put that before or after? All right, so we'll say eukaryotes. All right, so the idea is that, that there was, before, for example, the incorporation of these mitochondria, all life, say, was as single cells, right? So a single membrane enclosing what you might call the replicators. And then after that, there was incorporation of multiple kind of sub-replicators within each of these cells. So this is the emergence of eukaryotic cells, right? So with, for example, mitochondria. Yeah?
The Cambrian explosion?
Cambrian explosion, yeah. So that was, so that was a big event. So as far as, and we can certainly put it on here, but.
The Cox gene maybe.
Okay, so right, so development is kind of a, right, so the one question is, so along the course of the evolution of life, so that was a great development of diversity at various stages, right? And there were also some, for example, the rise of oxygen in the atmosphere, major changes in the life on this planet. And then the question is, I'll say it does not make this list, but you could make a slightly longer list. That and you can also ask about the question of, I would say that the list that Smith suggests has to do with maybe the process of evolution, rather than the major events in the history of the planet, per se, right? So that might be kind of the distinction that is going on here. All right, germline somatic separation is a big one. All right, so the idea here is that before this event, each of these cells that are replicating, their goal really is to transmit their genome to the next generations, right? Whereas with the emergence of a separation between the germline, I'd say the sperm and the egg, for example, from the rest of the cells, that's a really striking emergence of something that's very fundamentally different, right? Because then you have not only a multicellular organism, but also a multicellular organism in which the goal of some of those cells is not to transmit their DNA to the next generation, but to help another cell transmit its DNA. And of course, in this case, they're perhaps the same DNA, but this is still a striking development. Yeah.
It's not obvious that the sequence is multicellular. Multicellularity is a pretty vague term.
Yes.
It's possible that the order here, by multicellularity, you just be
Right. So the question is whether the separation of the germline had to occur after the multicellularity. And let me think of. I think that you're perhaps right. Although in many of the cases that we're thinking about, I mean, even in the simple cases like bull box and so forth, there is some sense there's a group of cells that get together and then you have a separation. But it's not strictly required.
How about the evolution of sex?
The evolution of sex. Yes, this is a good one, and I'm trying to think where I want to put it in here. All right. All right. Maybe we'll even put it right here. All right. It's certainly a a major event. There are many, and then you can also talk about the many different kinds of sex. And we're maybe not going to focus too much on this today, but it's certainly a major one. Yeah.
And also, ignorant people suggest suggestions, because I'm a non-biologist.
Yes.
And so for me, I'm not sure if anything exists like onset of DNA, but have a vague recognition that at some point there were only amino acids, and at some point they were structured in something that could self-replicate.
That's right. So we had to start somewhere, right? And the question is where do we start? And maybe we didn't start with amino acids. We probably did not start with amino acids, but we had to start somewhere, right? And let me see how far I should be. Okay, so how much space I should leave. Let's start here. All right, so maybe at some point there had to be self-replicators. In particular, self-replicators that are capable of what you might call heredity.
Isn't that redundant?
I think this is a very interesting point, in that you might think that it's redundant. And the question is, can we construct some sort of self-replicator that would not be capable of heredity? And I think maybe just before we get to another one, I think a possible example of this, you can imagine maybe an RNA strand, perhaps, that folds and it's able to combine two halves of itself to make itself. Okay, so what it is, it's an RNA, kind of folds up into some structure. And then if it finds two pieces, of itself, then it can take the two and it can attach them to each other. Right? Now, so this is a self-replicator, but is not necessarily capable of heredity in the sense that it cannot necessarily undergo evolution. Right? Because you can ask, well, what happens if, let's say that we have this this enzyme or this RNA, and it has, say, it's A1 and A. A2, right, and together it forms, itself, right? And the question is, well, what happens if instead of A2, it attaches A2 prime? Right? So this is some other sequence on the side.
Closely related.
It's closely related, right? And in particular, if this sequence is similar enough that this new sequence can still attach together two halves, but it may be that this new sequence still will want to attach together A1 and A2 rather than A1 and A2 prime. So that's somehow the distinction, right? So this would correspond to some sort of mutation event, right? So instead of grabbing A1 and A2, it grabs this A2 prime, it attaches them together, even if this is a functioning
replicator. That's true of alleles in general. One may be better than the other, but you still sometimes preserve the lesser allele.
Okay, I'm not just talking about better or I'm not just talking about the ability of to say attach the two sequences together. I'm talking about which sequences get attached.
Any heritable variation.
Yes.
By heredity. So that's, I think it would be fair to say heritable variation.
Okay.
If there's no heredity, it means that there's no correlation in the behavior of the offspring of the parent. That's in fact the opposite of what you're talking about.
I see. Okay, so you're saying that this should be
variation. If there's a change in the organism, the offspring of the organism.
The change somehow has to be heritable, I guess. Right? Yeah. Capable heredity. All right. Yeah, I'm not going to write anything else, but I think that's fair. All right. So, is everybody? You understand why I'm saying that this change has to somehow be carried through to the next generation in order for it to be capable of evolution?
Yeah, to be able to replicate itself in its new form. Yes.
Right. Yeah. Yes. And it has to be itself. I guess that's it has to be this A1 A2 prime rather than A1 A2.
Under eukaryotes and mitochondria, it would be nice to add chloroplasts instead.
Oh, yes, we can add, yeah.
Photosynthesis and G. World.
So there are a number of examples of this. Yes.
So how would you define a multicellularity? You think about metazoa? If you take the example of biofilm, okay, this is an example of multicellularity, and you have also a kind of germline and a somatic line.
Yes.
So right. It means that both of them should be before eukaryotes.
Oh, right, yeah. Yeah, no, I think this temporal sequence, I think, is very roughly temporal. Right. I think we should not take too seriously.
So this is not the timeline?
Well, I would say that it's a very rough timeline. But I think it depends on what you mean by multicellularity, right? Which is what you're saying. Yeah, and maybe what we'll do here is we're going to add developmental complexity within multicellularity. And that maybe is really after... it just depends on which aspects of this you're talking about. This is the nature of timelines that I don't think that you can necessarily do better, right? But I will add the developmental complexity. Between, so here, in particular, the idea that different cells will do very different things.
Because that doesn't necessarily imply repeatable spatial structure, which is typical of development. So those are separate.
Yeah, we can say complexity, and then an even more extreme version of this is real developmental. That's fine. We can say...
Okay.
Maybe specialization and then developmental complexity with that.
So Jeff, I would encourage you to go up level.
Up level.
Up level. Yeah. So I think what this is turning into is a debate between you and your program, which is
it'd be good
to not let that.
Okay. That's fine. All right. So, but I will just write this here, developmental complexity, and then we could say specialization for it.
If this is a timeline, what time is involved?
We're really focused on life here on Earth because that's what we have data for. Somebody was talking about string theory here a moment ago, right? What you can say is that 4.5 billion years ago, kind of when the Earth cooled, you could start talking about things happening, right? So we don't know precisely when this happened because it's very difficult to get evidence for it. But first, maybe someone can mention what happens. Maybe something in between these two things.
Cells.
All right, so cells are kind of a big thing. So I'll say first cells.
Self-replicating molecule.
Yeah, so this is the self-replicating molecule, right? So at some point, it was a self-replicating molecule. And that happened, presumably, we think, what you might say, soon after the Earth was cool. We don't have evidence for this, but soon is from the standpoint of compared to 4.5 billion years, right? So we still might have had to wait hundreds of millions of years. But something around 4 billion is what you might say for this. Whereas first cells, and actually I might even, since people are very intent on timelines, maybe I'll, this is the kind of thing that you can argue about, because the first cells, that occurred something like maybe 3.5 billion years. People can argue about this as well. But
How about the genetic code?
That's right. Yeah. So I think that a very interesting thing happened, which is that there was at some point we believe that RNA was likely the self-replicating molecule. Not necessarily that RNA was the first self-replicating molecule, but we think that maybe it was somewhere along the path of from the initial self-replicators to what happens later is that we think we had RNA. And at some point, that RNA, the role of the RNA, was split between protein and DNA. In particular, we think that RNA served both the role of transmitting the genetic information, but also performing the enzymatic roles. Whereas somewhere along here, this was split. Of course, RNA is still inside the cells, but it's not the primary, neither enzyme nor threaded carrier, okay, DNA. And right. So that's kind of the genetic code. Although You know, it depends on what you mean by genetic code. And where. But certainly, at this stage, you certainly call it a genetic code.
Question?
Yes.
In your picture, did death show up at the same time as sex or later?
Did what show up?
Death. Did it show up with sex or later? Before the germline.
I would say that death probably started.
No, single-celled animals do not die, right? And they just.
They don't age.
Let's talk
about aging.
Okay, so aging. I would submit that single cells do age, and there's a number of experiments that have looked at this, right? Callebaut, Crescentis, about 10 years ago, aging was studied, and certainly happens there.
In yeast, before aging. The first cell, or after the first cell?
Right. So aging. That's an issue. Right. So I think that aging is likely going to happen. All right. So. No experimental data on this, but I will. I think death is kind of everywhere. And then aging, I think that the first cells will likely probably also age. Okay, right. So that's death. The question is aging per se, and that's.
Protozoans will undergo senescence unless they have sex at some point.
Okay, but that's a more complicated form.
But see, a cell just dividing, it's not aging.
But they can accumulate. There's a whole theory about that.
That's what I'm saying. You have senescence before the next sexual event. That can be from a number of reasons.
I think that you can talk about aging independent of sex, and I think that aging is an interesting. You can talk about what you mean by aging.
Bell's book, Sex and Death in the Protozoa. The people interested in this have looked at that in single-celled organisms.
Sure. But there's data on single-celled organisms, right? So Suk-Jun, for example, E. coli. He has his mother machine where he can just watch an individual cell dividing over time, right? And what he sees is that there's no, in E. coli in his experiment, there's no decrease in the rate of division. Right? So the cells divide every half hour, and that's true for a long time. Since he can actually see 200 divisions of an individual cell. Right? So you might from there say there's no aging, right? Because you see, there's no decrease in the rate of division. However, he still sees an exponentially increasing probability of death per generation. Right, so this is telling you that the cells really are aging, at least based on, they're changing over time in some bad way. Right, I think that's a real aging.
You could also say that the self-replicator, just the molecule, would also age because over time it would lose its ability to self-replicate.
Yes, so I was debating whether to kind of get into this. So there's a question of what you mean by aging. We're talking about just a molecule. Presumably, chemical modifications can happen in various sorts, and then that should correspond to some sort of aging. Right, any time that you get right, if a side group falls off, that's aging. Right, I agree.
Are these changes believed to be induced by changes in the physical environment on the Earth, or are they believed to be just random mutations?
So the question is whether these changes that we're talking about, these major transitions, are somehow induced by the changes that are occurring on the planet, and how much of it is due to mutation, selection, and evolution itself. That's more mutations, right? I think that inevitably the answer is always both, but I would submit that most of this has to do with evolution. Itself, as compared to, obviously there are things that were happening over time on the planet that are very relevant. But I think that this process is somehow inherent in the evolutionary process itself. Right? I would suggest, although this is something that other people can certainly argue about. Yeah.
Just a remark on this. Actually, if you take the transition from anaerobic to aerobic atmosphere, this is a coupling between both.
That's right. That's right. So just the example of oxygen and this led to, you know, widespread change, you know, in life. It's both the environment and as a result of the living organisms.
So are you saying that on a different planet with, let's say, reasonably similar conditions as ours, it would evolve in a similar or same way?
Yeah. I think I am saying that, although this is the kind of thing that, you know, it's going to be hard. I think this gets to a question that people argue about a lot is, you know, how much contingency is there in evolution? In this process, one of the things that we see is that there's somehow an increase in complexity in the level of organization, right? And maybe I'll just actually just fill. There are a couple other ones I wanted to just fill out, and then we can talk about this complexity issue, right? Okay, so there was self-replicating molecules. Somewhere in here, the self-replicator was likely an RNA that split DNA protein. Also, somewhere in here, we're not truly sure where, roughly 3.5 billion, the initial emergence of cells. Eukaryotic cells, or even within the cell, you can have substructure, and some of these substructures came from other self-replicators. So there's somehow a combination of two self-replicators coming together. Evolution of sex, multicellularity, developmental complexity, germline. And I'm just going to mention over here the evolution of groups, complex societies such as ourselves. And some people will include new social species. So ants and such. But I also will not talk very much about that. Yes?
Sorry, where would you put lipids?
Lipids. Yeah, so lipids of some sort were important for the emergence of the first cells.
Yeah, so are they among the self-replicators?
Right. So there's a question of how the self-replicators became enclosed in some sort of lipid, fatty acid of some sort, right? So how is it that process took place? And then you can argue about, you know, which thing you think is the self-replicator. Is that going to be where you're...
No, I'm just an egg question. I don't know if lipids can replicate themselves or not.
Okay. Yes, so in here, so the idea is that this membrane that is defining the cell is some sort of lipid, and people have done a fair amount of work looking into this. And I don't know. I guess Irene Chen is not here now, but she is. She's around sometime this week. So she.
She's on campus.
Okay, very good. So she did some very interesting and important work with Jack Szostak, looking at some of this question of what you call protocells. So, you know, if we want to try to understand, you know, these first cells, how could they have arisen? How could they divide? How could there be some advantage associated with them, right? And in these first cells, one of the things that she's shown is that with at least some of these simple lipids, fatty acids, that just using osmotic pressure, you can get growth of some of these possible protocells. So the idea is, and what she actually did was she put sucrose, just the simple sugar, inside some of these cells, and this creates some tension in the membrane. Right? What that does is it attracts new fatty acids to this cell at the expense of other cells that don't have as much osmotic pressure. Right, so the idea is that, in principle, if you had some self-replicator inside this protocell that generated osmotic pressure, it could lead to the growth of this protocell. And then eventually, as it gets larger, just some simple kind of shear kinds of forces can lead to division, or the equivalent of division, where you get two independent cells.
But as far as I know, there's no evidence that a fatty acid can replicate on its own.
Right.
These experiments, you have to add the fatty acids.
That's right. So, but in later experiments, they also did this thing where they, and I can't remember if this was her or someone else in Szostak's group, but where they had some genetic polymer of some sort that they argued could generate that osmotic pressure. And I think there are arguments about how well this would work, though. Yeah.
Could you say what's adaptive about multicellularity? I mean,
yeah.
Just count the numbers, right?
All right, great, yeah, so what, yeah, so, right, so adaptive, and in particular, more broadly, I think, why is it that life did this? right? All these different stages. And this is, I guess, where I wanted to talk about what I see as some similarities in many of these different transitions.
Right? One more
suggestion
here that you really left out, which is cell motility.
Cell motility, yes.
It goes back after your first cells, probably, but it's critical to everything else.
Okay, so we can, I often study yeast, and they're not very motile, and so I feel like, I like motility, but at the same time, motility, I'll say, is important.
But to insist on what Lars already said, I expect there are probably 20,000 different items you can put on this thing, and if your colleagues keep suggesting them, I won't get to the end of this talk.
Yes.
Much like to do because this seems so exciting.
All right. Okay. So why don't we say that we can say that this is the list that I will put up here, and there are obviously many other important events in the history of life, and we can talk about those over wine and cheese. at the end of the day today. All right, so in particular, I wanted to talk about what these transitions have that are perhaps in common. So the question is, what is similar here? And I think that there are at least two things that are really important and interesting. One is that in many of these, what you see is that the individual replicators are giving up their ability to replicate independently, right? So the replicators are really combining in some way. Replicators combining or cooperating. Okay. Now, you can see this here. You have self-replicators. They're pining their fate together in individual cells, right? You can see, in this case, two individual cells, right? One being engulfed by another and forming the first eukaryotic cell. Similarly, you can see in eukaryotes, multicellularity is the example that this workshop was kind of motivated by, but individual eukaryotes coming together, for example, or prokaryotes for that matter, multicellularity. And then that process can become even further removed. Instead of having these two self-replicators tying their face together in a multicellular organism, you can go all the way to the point where one of those cells doesn't even try to replicate and pass its genome on independently, and it tries to instead pass on the germline. Then as we continue on, obviously in groups, and then eusocial species are perhaps a more extreme form of this. Okay. And so I think that this is really a very common theme throughout these major transitions. And so when we talk about cooperation and the importance of it, and we bring up multicellularity, I guess I think it's certainly relevant and important, but I think that the ideas of cooperation and, we'll see, cheating really are really come all the way through these major transitions in the history of life. Yes?
That's okay about the similarities, but what's being optimized in each step?
Yes, what's being optimized? Okay, so let's talk about that for a moment. So what is similar? So this is one of the things. And I think the other thing here is that as this occurs, you can take advantage of the economies of scale and specialization.
So isn't it fitness that gets optimized? As one ignorant non-biologist would expect.
Yes. Okay. So, all right. So now the question is, there's a discussion that someone sent out about whether this is tautological, that evolution is optimizing the ability to transmit itself into future generations. And I think that there's some sense in which it is tautological, but it still, I think, is deep and true. So I don't have a problem with something being tautological in that sense. And there still is something that's amazing that happens, right? So I think it's true that the goal here is to transmit copies of oneself to future generations. And the question is, well, what's the best way of doing that? Yes?
About the optimization, there are two ways of thinking evolution.
One is about the fitness. If you grow faster, then you invade the population, or the survival. I mean, if you don't have a competitor, your survival, even if you are not optimized to your environment.
Okay, so you're saying...
I'm just saying that the species that we are observing today, for sure, they are survived.
Yes.
This means that we don't know if they are optimized for their environment. We just know that they are survived.
Right. So I think that, and underlying this comment is really something about a question of time scales. Right. So often when we talk about fitness, somehow we're really thinking about fitness right now. So, you know, who divides faster? No, you don't. You're not. Okay. Good. I think that here the point is that what you want, in some sense, evolution is maximizing passing on your copies of your genome. You know, somehow. And eventually far into the future, right? In a sense, certainly if we're looking back, right, the only species that are still, that are with us today are ones that did survive somehow throughout this whole period, right? So there's kind of short-term evolution, but then that can give you different results from long-term evolution, I'd say. Yes?
Why do you insist on assuming a goal? You know, it could be that a goal is itself an evolutionary transition, and a goal is something that we can recognize and we may have a goal, but it could be that simple replicators are just there because they are there and they have no real goal. And I think that enforcing the notion of goal at this stage could be totally misleading.
Yes.
All right, so a goal. So the goal that I suggested is this goal that is somehow tautological, right? That, you know, just passing on. So I feel like this is the weakest form of a goal, because it's just saying that whatever is there into the future is what evolution is maximizing. So I guess I don't feel like I'm imposing my will too much on evolution in that standpoint. But you could certainly disagree with that.
But I still don't understand. We use a word like fitness. Is it being applied at the individual level, the species level?
Yes.
At the genome level, isn't it?
Yes.
Could you explain what's more adaptive of being a sponge, a bunch of swimming bacteria of the same number?
I think now there are two questions here. Right? One is where, at what level of organization should we be looking at fitness?
Yeah. Okay. Right?
And another is why might you want to join to a larger group? You're saying that what's more adaptive than these free swimming bacteria? Right. So I'd say that in regards to the first question, I would say that often it's fruitful to look at fitness on different levels, but in many cases you have to look at lower levels to resolve kind of conflicts, or to figure out what's going on. In particular, to try to understand cases in which maximizing fitness at this level can be undermined by what you might call cheating behaviors at a lower level. Right? So in many cases, to figure out what's going on, you do have to go down to what I would call lower levels of organization, down to the individual genes or genomes, say.
I'll be happy if you just say what you're talking about.
All right, genomes. Yeah, we'll say genomes, but in many ways the way that you can increase the number of genomes that you send into the future is by increasing the fitness of some group, right? So they're not always at cross purposes, I would say.
And the sponge.
Right, and the sponge. So why is it that you might be able to increase fitness by combining into these higher orders? And all right, so we can. All right, so this gets us to the economies of scale and specialization, I'll say, and that it's often the case that wider groups can do more than individual, say, replicators. Right, so, for example, one thing that my favorite example here. All right, well, for example, combining so the eukaryotes. So this is more complicated cells that have individual compartments. So, for example, here, one of the advantages of a cell is that you can control your environment. And in particular, the environment can be different from outside the cell. Now, here, you can have multiple internal environments. Right, so this is a case where by having multiple kind of cells within a cell, you can have different, for example, pH. Right? The lysosome that breaks down proteins inside a cell, it's acidic. Right? This would be very bad for the rest of the cell, but because it's in a separate compartment, it allows for, in this case, specialization between the different compartments. Right? And that increases this fitness, the ability for the cell to pass on its genome into future generations.
But one of these is addressing robustness, and the other one is addressing something rather different.
All right, so right now I would say that this what I just was talking about, what I would say is not robustness, but simply...
Environmental control is a robustness issue.
Oh, I don't think it's just robustness. I think self-replicators can divide more rapidly if they can control their environment. All right, so if you can control, for example, the pH that the self-replicator is going to take place in, then you can increase the rate of replication. And so I think that being able to control the environment is important, even independent of questions of robustness. It's also the case that that cell may be able to go into new environments or will be more resistant to perturbations. Like, I have questions of robustness, but I would say that it's also important just from the standpoint of fitness, you know, this ability to pass on genomes into the future.
Can you use the code word for jargon?
Yes. Because,
you said you can have something at high level and cheating behavior at all.
Yes.
Level. Can you define cheating?
Yes. Behavior? All right. Okay, so cheating. All right. Well, one of the things that we said was that something similar in many of these different transitions is this cooperation that's taking place between replicators. Okay. Now, that allows these replicators to go perhaps into environments they wouldn't otherwise be able to go into or increase their fitness. But any time that you have such cooperation between individuals or replicators, then you have to ask the question of whether that cooperation is stable. So for example, Right from the very beginning, there's a challenge. Okay. Self-replicators, how is it that can actually happen? How can you get a self-replicator that has heredity? Okay. Well, the simplest way to do this is based on what we already know about, for example, DNA and RNA, which is that they can form a template for another self-replicator. Right? In this case, you would maybe need to do two replications in order to get back to where you started. You guys? This is a simple way to get what I would call self-replicators with this kind of heredity that we're talking about. Okay. Now, the problem with this is that you cannot both be an enzyme and a template at the same time, at least probably not. Okay. So to be an enzyme, you have to fold up into a very particular way so that you can do something. For example, attach these two sequences together. However, to be a template, that requires that you're, you know, somehow unfolded, that you're open and accessible to the environment, to be this template for the next copy. Right? Now, in that case, this replication is fundamentally a cooperative behavior, because if you yourself are acting as this guy that is attaching two sequences together, then you're not necessarily the one that is being replicated. You're replicating someone else.
Well, it depends on whether you and someone else are, you know, enzyme and template, or maybe, you know, the whole thing. So it depends on what you define as an individual.
All right. So right now I'm talking about there's some sequence. There's a molecule.
Okay.
All right. Now, certainly if I gave you two of these molecules, and if they could somehow alternate, right, it doesn't have to be a strict alternation, but you can imagine if they could somehow alternate, they could replicate each other, and if they're the same sequence, that's all wonderful, right? But the problem is that one of those sequences might not be replicating the other as much. And so this brings up this question of cheating. You know, how is it that you can actually make sure that all of these replicators are actually replicating each other? Okay. What's interesting is that this next maybe major transition actually partially could be some sort of solution to this problem. Okay. And that once you have a cell right? Then the fitness, the ability of that cell to divide, is going to be tied, in principle, to the ability of the replicators inside to divide or to replicate themselves, right? What this means is that you have not only this cooperation that allows, in principle, for economies of scale, controlled environment, and so forth, but this is also actually perhaps a mechanism for weeding out cheaters. Because if one cell has a population, has too many of these cheater replicators that are not replicating the others, that cell, in the picture of Irene Chen, maybe will not get as much, the osmotic pressure will not build as quickly, so that cell will not grow as rapidly as some other cells that have more of the cooperator type self-replicators. Right. So I think that this is an interesting example of a transition in evolution that could bring economies of scale and specialization, but also can perhaps act as some sort of cheater control mechanism. Yes?
I appreciate you can't be too particular, but about these transitions, I thought the replicators combining was a really good comment. Is it fair for me to say that at each stage, perhaps it's the probability of long-term survival that's going up? I know.
Okay.
You can't make it precise, but is that a reasonable thing to think? Is that a...
All right, so, okay, I think that there are a number of things to say. First, we may not have these standalone self-replicators anymore, but we certainly have simple cells that are still around and happy and dividing. And I think this comes to this question of what, if we want to try to ask what is happening as we move to the right on this board, right? There's some sense that there's an increase in complexity or so, right? But that doesn't mean that it's necessarily accurate to say that evolution is trying to increase complexity. What I would say is that there's some sense that there are various niches that are available in the world, on the planet. And some set of niches you can occupy fine as just individual cells in a soup. But then some niches require that you do other things. Right, so there's a sense that, so if you just look at, what is the most complicated organism on the planet as a function of time? Right, so we started 4.5 billion years ago, and then we've arrived at today. There is a sense that the most complicated organism has, we think, become more complicated over time. Right? But it does not necessarily mean that that's something that evolution kind of set out to do, but that could just be the case that there's some possibility for new niches that can be occupied. Yeah.
So there's you kind of cherry pick this to meet these criteria here, because, for example, when Jen Glazer said cell motility, you didn't put it up there. So there's a lot of things, right? I mean, there's a lot of things that aren't cooperative. That say vertebrae.
Yeah.
A vertebrae, opposable thumbs. Sight. Vision, different. There's so many traits that were important for invading new niches, for example.
Right.
Hard body parts and the Cambrian explosion. And so these are the criteria you use to assemble the board, okay? So it's kind of like that should go first, right? Things that are cooperative or economies of scale or specialization.
Sure, although I would say that I did verbally give those things that I saw as underlying.
Well, you put these out here as if they're important, like there's a second criterion, like some criterion you're using to pick these.
All right, so I think that it's not. Okay, so first of all, I think that there is a sense that these things are important for the process of evolution in the sense that opposable thumbs is not. Okay. But also, I would say this is not my list.
What is it?
I think that's from Murray and Maynard Smith, who organized a book along that principle, and that's how it came up.
Yeah, so I'd say that this is not, I mean, it's not even my list, so I can't claim credit or castigation for it, either, whatever.
I just think it can help people understand, because they're wondering what's the big theme, right? I mean, these are the things that you chose. These things are important. These are traits that were important for exploring new niches, and there are a lot of other things, but you're focusing on ones that are relevant to the problem of cooperation.
All right, so I will say that I believe that these, I think that Maynard Smith did a pretty good job in terms of, I think that these really are, what I would say, probably perhaps the big important ones. Although I don't feel like I have to convince everyone of this either, because it's not my list. So if you, I would say it's fine if you want to think of it as some major things that happen in evolution, for which these things are true, and that's okay. And even under that interpretation, though, I guess I would simply say that not only multicellularity is so the connection between cooperation and evolution is not limited to multicellularity. It occurs over many different scales. I guess that's the primary point that I want to make.
And I think the niche perspective is certainly reasonable, but you know, then you could also say, you know, when you start breathing oxygen, that's a huge niche.
Yes.
That's not here because it doesn't
that's right.
Require cooperation. I mean, that's not.
Yeah, yeah. No, I think that's. I think that's fine.
I mean, if I understand correctly, our program is about cooperation and multicellularity, not all of evolution and everything that might have fed into it. So I think it's reasonable to focus on a couple of these things here as you have.
I'm glad.
But maybe a very faithful person could start wondering, I mean, could you ever start breathing oxygen if you didn't cooperate in the first place?
Right? Yeah, that's fair.
I think if you didn't breathe oxygen.
They did much earlier than that, apparently.
Yeah, but
I think we're probably not going to converge on this particular topic.
So I'm going to urge you to have 5 minutes. So what do you think physicists need to know?
Right, so
take home message.
All right, very good, very good.
No more questions in biology.
Cell people have to pipe down.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
All right, so I have 5 minutes, but do you want to, if you want.
No, it goes back to physics, actually, because we. Every time we say if cooperation and something, okay, so it means that we have the choice. Okay, so what is the difference between cooperation and a well of energy?
What is the difference between cooperation and a well of energy?
If you have two molecules, okay,
yeah.
And so the interaction is driven by the minimization of energy. So what is the difference between something that is expected from this thing and...
Okay, all right, so...
I don't think you have to answer the question.
All right, so I guess I'll just briefly say, I think that the laws of physics are followed in living systems. All right, so maybe that's all the answer that I'll give on. Right. Okay. So, so I just want to talk a little bit more about this question about what you get by going through here, and highlight the question of cooperation and cheating as we move through here. I want to just mention on this question of how complexity perhaps grows over time, or the maximal complexity grows over time. I think that there's also a sense in which the maximal, say, intelligence of a species grows over time. I recently went to a really fascinating talk by Jeff Marcy, who is studying exoplanets. So he, in his kind of the last 5-10 minutes where he was allowed to speculate, one of the things he said is that evolution does not necessarily favor an increase in intelligence. Right? So you can look at lineages of dinosaurs and whatnot and ask about how the brain size changes over time, and what you find is that there's no increase in brain size along a particular lineage of, say, dinosaur. Right? And I think that that's totally reasonable and believable, but there's a very clear empirical statement, which is that if you ask about whatever metric of intelligence you want to use, there is some sense in intelligence, the maximal intelligence, is growing over time. And this is relevant for exoplanets because we're wondering about whether we're going to get visited by green men.
But of course, if you start with, unless you think your initial self-replicator is infinitely intelligent, the only direction you can go.
I agree. I agree. But let's say that we want to start anywhere, not only at 4.5 billion years, but at 3 billion or 2 billion or one. Now this argument no longer holds. Right? That once you have some intelligence, it could, in principle, you could imagine anything happening. I mean,
because there's still some maximum value, and you can, and if you have fluctuations, some of them are going to move up.
Yes, I know.
If you diffuse, you can't. I mean,
I agree. I guess
it's a trivial statement to say that evolution produces increasing complexity and increasing intelligence.
Yeah, no, I agree, but I think it's still true. I think it's true, I agree with you. But I would say that very smart people say other things. That's the only thing that I.
I'm usually talking about selection within a population.
Yeah.
Which is just one lineage.
Okay. All right. Great. So as we move forward, what you see is that there are many opportunities where species or replicators come together in order to do new things, but as we move over here to the right, there are also many opportunities where we have the emergence of cheater type behaviors. Right. So this happens in many different cases. We have cancer in multicellular organisms. Obviously, we have cheating behaviors within societies that we spend a lot of time thinking about what to do. And so if you want to try to understand those dynamics, then you really have to think about some of these ideas from game theory in terms of what can you do to limit the ability of these cheater strategies to spread throughout the population. But I think that with that, I think I will go ahead and let us. I don't, you guys might have already had lunch, but but yeah, I think I'll close that.
I'm not sure about your grade, but I got one question.
So how would you define cheating? So why is cancer cheating?
Right. Okay. Yeah. So when I talk about cheating, what I'm referring to is some behavior or genotype that increases the fitness at this lower level of organization, but decreases the fitness at the higher level of organization. Okay, so that would be a case where if you have a group of cells that are collectively, for example, breaking down some sugar, and that's a nice high fitness state for the group, but you can have the emergence of cheater strategies where one of those cells stops contributing to that public good, and that cell may be able to divide more rapidly than the rest of the population. So it's increasing the fitness at that cell level, but it's decreasing the fitness at the higher level, at the level of the population. Right, so I'd say in general, when we talk about cheating, it's this difference between fitness at a low level versus a high level.
Sean was coming from a completely different background. I'm curious to know what the physicist's perspective brings to this that's different from the evolutionary biologist. What tools or techniques, how does physics play a role in this?
Yeah, so this is an important question. Why is it that physicists have gotten excited about this recently? Mm-hmm. Right. And I think that there are a couple of different answers, and it may be different for some of the experimentalists versus the theorists.
Yeah, from the theorist perspective.
From the theorist perspective, I was ready with the experimental. Maybe I'll give my experimental answer, and then one of the theorists can give quite tell you why there. So from my standpoint, I would say that within the field of evolution and also in ecology, I think that there are a lot of big, really beautiful ideas, but there's comparatively little data to really address the question. So from my standpoint as an experimentalist, I would say that I really like the nature of the ideas, but just the connection between theory and experiment that is so powerful in the traditional domains of physics has not, I think, as effectively been applied within kind of evolution and ecology. Right? So as an experimentalist, I guess my goal is to find some of these pretty ideas that I like and then make measurements, maybe with well-controlled systems in the laboratory that may address those questions. Although I don't know if do you want to say why?
Boris could answer that question.
Boris,
maybe he could speak on that.
Is that Kawhine?
Maybe maybe all the theorists are too embarrassed to give their answer. Yeah, no, but
we'll reach you at 5, and Boris will sling.